is there to deal with those things. The idea that it's an in-house incident. But, what you know, it's been mishandled or overlooked, not handled at all for decades, forever. But what's amazing is because these young women rose up, they said, this is not acceptable. This is not a legitimate way to deal with it. Because they use social media, their voices, the mainstream media, they're organizing to say, this has to stop, this has to change. They're really radically changing how it's being treated and exposing the universities, which are universities from California to Rhode Island, from Florida to Alaska, and saying, this is going to change. And they are changing it. This is a very exciting time in feminism. I think that we're shifting things profoundly.
Rebecca Solnit, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Her new book is called Men Explain Things to Me. And that does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Dina Guzdar. Special happy birthday to Mike DeFilippo. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the world at www.kbu.fm. Stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News coming up here shortly.
You hear a lot of anti-corporate talk. Are you hearing it? A lot of anti-corporate talk. And I'm such a bleeding heart. I can't help but think, you know, who will stand up for these corporations? Because corporations, you know, they're not greedy, cynical, evil monoliths. They're people. Greedy, cynical, evil people. And it turns out there is a group standing up for the rights of these people. The group is called the Citizens United. Exxon. You've been living in the shadow, whispering in the back room, where no one can hear a word. Oh, Exxon, child, I just friended you on Facebook, 'cause the Citizens United say your voice should be heard.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Evening News. A hacker associated with Anonymous gets off without jail time for informing on other hackers in the movement.
Portland takes part in a global day of action against Monsanto this past weekend. We'll get a full report.
The U.S. Supreme Court rules on an Oregon case that could have wide implications for protests in the U.S. We'll be right back. Portland Water Bureau continues to deal with the E. coli contamination by observing federal regulations for public safety. Portland is underway covering Powell Butte and Kelly Butte reservoirs. For more on this story, we turn to Barbara Nelson for KBOO Evening News, who spoke with David Schaff of the Portland Water Bureau.
What do you think is the source of the E. coli?
Well, it's animals. It's animal waste. That's what E. coli tells us, is that we have a bacteria that is fecal in nature. That's all it tells you. So we know it's from some animal, whether it's human or, you know, bird or raccoon. We can't tell you that. But we do know it's a bacteria that's fecal in nature. That's what E. coli tells us.
Can you explain what flushing your tap for 2 minutes does to prevent E. coli?
Well, all it's doing is clearing your water out that's been sitting in your tap if you haven't been using it. Before you drink it, before you consume it, you know, let it run nice and cool and cold. We say that to everybody first thing in the morning, especially if you have a house that has lead in it. You know, flush your standing water out.
When is the last time the system had an E. coli outbreak?
Well, it's never had an E. coli outbreak. We test on a regular basis. We take about 240 samples a year, and about half a dozen times a year we get what referred to as a positive sample, where it tests positive for something called a total coliform, and that's a very wide variety of bacteria that are relatively easy to identify. A subcategory of that is E. coli, and that's much more rare. We did have one earlier this year in February, but April. And then the last time we'd had one, I believe, was in 2012. So we didn't have any in 2013, but we did have total coliforms.
Would you say that the city is safe now?
Oh, I would say absolutely. And I think the city was safe before. What happens is that the regulations are set up in such a way that they are written to be very conservative and protective of public health. That's why when people in the United States go from one city to another, they rarely ask, if ever, hey, is the water in this town safe to drink? So the regulations are very conservative, and I think from the public health perspective, from the water system perspective, from the regulatory perspective, everybody would agree that the actual risk to public health is very, very, very small. But you're not supposed to be able to find bacteria in your treated drinking water. And so when you do, that sets in motion all sorts of regulatory actions. And in this case, when we had it repeat 3 days in a row, that's when the Oregon Health Authority said you are going to be required to issue this boil water notice.
Is there any chance or evidence that the contamination might have been deliberate?
No. One of the things we do when we have any positive, whether it's a total coliform or total coliform E. coli, hang on, just sorry, I swallowed wrong there. Sorry. One of the things that happens is that we send our staff out to where the sample was taken and do what I would call sort of an environmental survey. So they, in the case of the reservoirs, they walk around the reservoir, they look in the water. We look for obvious signs that something occurred. And we do it at the sample station at 2nd and Salmon. So we go down and we look, and what's the environmental signs? I mean, is there a tree that's overhanging that has a bunch of crows in it that are dropping feces on top of our sample station? So we do that environmental scan.
The proposed covering of our reservoirs prevent this from happening in the future?
Well, it's not a guarantee. you know, covering the reservoirs is something that we're mandated to do, that every water system in the country is mandated to do. But there will still be the potential for having total coliforms, and even total coliforms that reflect a fecal contamination, but they should be pretty darn rare. It's just that the open reservoirs have a particular vulnerability. It's one we all know about. I mean, obviously that water is treated, and obviously things get introduced into that water. You don't have ducks in the pipes, so there's less vulnerability with a closed system. But it doesn't guarantee it, no.
If we were to cover the reservoirs, how much do you propose it would cost?
Well, we're actually in the process of doing that right now. I mean, we are building two new reservoirs at Powell Butte and Kelly Butte because of the mandate from the federal government that came out in 2006 called LT2. So that actually is ongoing, and it's ongoing throughout the country. Every water system in the country is under a mandate to stop storing their treated drinking water out in the open.
And how would it be funded?
Well, it's funded by our ratepayers. Unfortunately, the federal government has not provided any water systems with financial assistance. So this is what we refer to as an unfunded mandate. It comes out of your pocket and my pocket and all of our ratepayers' pockets, including our wholesale customers.
Okay, well, you've answered my questions, and I want to thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
That was Barbara Nelson speaking with David Schaff about the E. coli contamination last Friday.
Hundreds of Portlanders marched downtown on Saturday protesting the company Monsanto and genetically modified foods. Organizers of Portland's march against Monsanto want to raise awareness about the dangers and damage that GMO foods and pesticides are doing to clean water, food, and health. Last Tuesday, voters in Southern Oregon's Josephine and Jackson counties passed measures to ban GMO crops. These laws are in opposition to Governor Kitzhaber's bill prohibiting local governments from regulating genetically engineered crops. Although Jackson County was given an exemption, these new laws have set the stage for court opposition. Governor Kitzhaber has created a task force to study the issue. We'll have a full report following this newscast at 5:45, including sounds from the protest recorded on Saturday by KBOO reporter Paul Rowland.
In an effort to prevent extensive oil drilling, global teams of environmental campaigner with Greenpeace staged a direct action to block two different oil rigs in the Arctic. One of the rigs was owned by Russian energy oil giant Gazprom, which was headed out to drill in the Pechora Sea. 30 activists were allowed to occupy the rig for 5 hours until detained and arrested. Meanwhile, 15 Greenpeace activists boarded an oil rig located in the Barents Sea, owned by Norwegian oil company Statoil. According to Greenpeace, the occupation is ongoing and not being resisted by the ship's crew. This is just part of a global campaign to stop offshore drilling and unsustainable fishing practices in the pristine Arctic waters. The environment matters to all of us, and protecting it demands a truly global response, said a spokesperson for Greenpeace International. These developments allow similar direct actions initiated by Greenpeace, including the Arctic 30 of last year.
Researchers have found a new way to help the average American take more responsibility for the environment. Studies have shown that when the term global warming is used instead of climate change, people felt more deeply about the situation. Even though the two terms mean practically the same thing, the term global warming tends to create panic and a more disturbing picture in the person's mind, but it is also easier to relate to. Studies have shown that an average of 13% of Americans think global warming is a bad thing. African Americans were 20% more likely to connect global warming as a very threatening situation as opposed to when the term climate change is used, while Latinos were 30% more likely. Politicians prefer to use the term climate change for several reasons. In his first term, President Obama and the Democrats avoided talk of global warming and climate change specifically to prevent a lack of cooperation from Republicans, so instead touched upon topics related to clean energy and creating more green jobs. Some campaign groups have argued that the term global warming generates too much politic controversy, and since the Bush administration preferred using the term climate change, some feel that the term will sit better with Republicans and make them more comfortable to engage on the issue. With a survey of more than 1,600 people conducted at the end of last year showing that most people weren't interested in the term climate change, it seems that the global warming should be the preferred term, and that would help focus more public attention on the topic and bring it more centrally into public and political discourse.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the Secret Service agents acted within the law when they forced anti-George Bush protesters to move to a so-called free speech area during a protest here in Oregon in 2004. The protesters were forced to move away from a hotel in Jacksonville, Oregon, where then-President George W. Bush was dining. The anti-Bush demonstrators said that the agents violated their free speech rights and discriminated against their viewpoint by forcing them to move while pro-Bush supporters were allowed to stay. Here's a recording of the testimony in front of the Supreme Court back in March.
Your Honor, I think that the court's hesitance to recognize Bivens and the factors that go into that gave the court hesitance to extend Bivens to First Amendment claims are relevant to the analysis here. We didn't raise this argument because it wasn't preserved below, but we do think the very same factors that would give the court pause about recognizing a Bivens actions are the ones that would cause the court to reverse the Ninth Circuit's
decision. Well, on the merits of the case, if you were called to brief the Secret Service, what would you say in response to this question? Do we have any duties under the First Amendment when we are protecting the president with respect to crowds and people that are close to him? Do we have any First Amendment duty?
Your Honor, we would, first of all, as the policy, I know Your Honor's asked this, but I just want to make clear, there's a policy that would generally prohibit the Secret Service from doing that, an internal policy.
They're asking about the law. They say, we want to know what the law is. We're law enforcement officers. Will you please tell us what the law is?
I would say, Your Honor, that the law is not clearly established. This court has never held that the
Secret Service... That's why we've invited you to lunch, so that you will tell us what the law is.
I understand that, Your Honor. And we may yet get clarity. But
you actually are arguing that it's not...
Could I have the answer to Justice Kennedy's question?
I think I would have to say in candor, Your Honor, that in part because of some of the discussion we're having, that we think the better view of the law would be if you have an objective security rationale for the action, that the retaliatory animus would not render that unconstitutional.
I would have to say
that that's not clearly established.
Do you think it's not clearly established that you can't discriminate solely? I use the word solely. No security reason, no nothing. You can't discriminate solely on the basis of viewpoint.
That's correct, Your Honor. We agree with that.
That's constitutionally established.
I take that as different from the hypothetical that Justice Scalia...
No. Let me go step by step.
You agree
that's clearly established?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. What you don't think is clearly established is a mixed motive case.
That's correct.
That's a different issue. So the question here is... is this a mixed motive case or not?
Your Honor,
that the other side, I think, is saying it's not, that there was no valid security reason, no objective security reason for this move.
And I think our response to that, Your Honor, is we would agree that's clearly established. If no reasonable officer could believe there was a security rationale and it was only on the basis of animus, then it would be clearly established.
That's not a mixed motive. Why do you accept the description of that as a mixed motive case?
I don't think, Justice, if you agreed
with my hypothetical.
Today's decision by the U.S. Supreme Court could have widespread implications for future protests, as it follows the Secret Service to designate certain areas as so-called free speech zones and could refuse to allow protests outside of those zones.
The group Healthcare for All Oregon plans to gather outside Portland City Council meeting tomorrow morning to demand that the city disclose the amount of money paid by Providence Healthcare to rename the Timber Stadium to Providence Field. In February, the Portland Timbers announced that naming rights for its stadium had been given to Providence for an undisclosed amount. This comes soon after Moda Health purchased naming rights to the Rose Garden for $40 million. Healthcare for all For All Oregon is a nonprofit organization committed to bringing access to health care to Oregonians without having to pay premiums, deductibles, copays, or any other cost. The group has been concerned about the high price being paid for advertising at the expense of patient care. A representative of the group spoke with KBOO News about tomorrow's action.
We've been trying to ask Mayor Hale to disclose the amount of money that was paid for Providence Park to rename the Timber Stadium Providence Park, and we've gotten nothing from his office. So we're taking the next step, and we're going to go to City Council, and during the public comment period, you know, as many of us as possible are going to get up there and make the request. Also, there'll be some of us standing outside and just, you know, maybe with signs saying, please disclose the amount. We're just trying to step up the pressure on the city to tell us what rightfully is information we should have. Providence Park paid, we don't know how much for it. We know Moda paid $40 million for the Rose Garden, and Providence Park bought the naming rights to Civic Stadium, and we don't know how much. And they refuse to disclose it. We're saying it's an open records situation. We have a right to know. The city, the last thing the city said is, we really don't have time to look for the information. We're too busy. And we know they can access it really fast. It's an excuse. We believe that we really should have a system where, a single-payer type system or Medicare for All system where everything is paid for. No premiums, no deductibles, no copays, and everyone has a right to health care. And this basically shows that it's another reason why that's a system we really need. Take profit out of it. Once profit becomes a motive, money that should go to health care goes to other things. It should be a publicly administered, privately delivered system. Medicare has, 3% overhead? And that's what we envision in a single-payer type system. There'll be little overhead. Sure, doctors will have to advertise, hospitals will advertise, but they won't be spending tens of millions. We won't have insurance companies spending tens of millions of dollars. And that's health care money. Other issues involved. One is that Providence, the workers in Providence, their benefits were put on hold, and their benefits suffered because of this. I mean, not because of this, but benefits that they have asked for, benefits that they're not getting, could be provided by this money spent on advertising.
That was Lisa with Healthcare for All Oregon. The group will be gathering at 9:15 tomorrow outside Portland City Hall to demand that Mayor Hales disclose the amount of money that Providence Healthcare paid for the naming rights to the Timbers Stadium.
Yet another mass shooting on a college campus took place this weekend in California. The man targeted random women and then took his own life. The shooter went on a rampage Friday night in Santa Barbara, killing 6 people and injuring 13 others. Then he took his own life in his car. In the car, police found 3 semi-automatic handguns, along with magazines loaded with more than 400 rounds of ammunition, all bought legally at local gun stores. California has the strictest gun laws in the nation. Facebook took down a page describing the shooter as an American hero. Facebook initially decided to leave the page up, but after pushback from many groups, including The Guardian, the page has been taken down. Facebook released a statement saying that the page violated its statement of rights and responsibilities. The shooter's manifesto focused on his hatred of women and was filled with misogynistic statements and ideas. A Twitter hashtag called Yes All Women began trending on Saturday and has included thousands of personal stories of harassment and abuse of women that participants say point to a larger problem of misogyny in the U.S. society.
The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has released a new report based on thousands of newly released government documents exposing a widespread spying effort on the Occupy Wall Street protests nationwide by fusion centers used to coordinate national and local law enforcement agencies. The new documents roll back the curtain on the fusion centers and show the communications, interactions, and emails of a massive national web of federal agents, officials, police, and private, quote, security, unquote, contractors. These officers accumulated and shared information reporting on all manner of peaceful and lawful political activity that took place during the Occupy movement, from protests and rallies to meetings and educational lectures. This enormous spying and monitoring apparatus included the Pentagon, FBI, DHS, police departments and chiefs, private contractors, and commercial business interests. For more, KBOO's Jenka Stoderberg spoke with Carl Missineo, the legal director for the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund.
First of all, maybe you could tell us what fusion centers are, and then we can talk about their role in Occupy.
Sure. The fusion centers were created after the 9/11 attacks, ostensibly to share information about catastrophic acts of terrorism and other national security threats. They really operate in the shadows. They receive hundreds of millions of dollars of funding, and there's not a lot that is known about what in fact they do. However, in 2012, a Senate subcommittee report did conclude that they provide very little information of value to that anti-terrorism mission. There are 78 fusion centers that are run by local and state law enforcement across the country. And what we've done is we've secured over 4,000 documents that are related to the operations of these fusion centers, not against Al-Qaeda, not against acts of purported catastrophic violence, but in fact against acts of peaceful dissent and the Occupy movement.
And are they connected with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is something we've heard about here in Oregon? There's been some debate about, but there hasn't been a lot of talk about the fusion centers because they just haven't been out there in the media.
Well, that's right. And they are connected with the Joint Terrorism Task Forces. Many of the people who are on the JTTFs actually wear multiple hats so that they work. They will have email addresses that are both federal, that are both local, that work with fusion, that are from fusion centers, as well as JTTF official email addresses. So that you've got the JTTFs operating as an element of this information sharing process and this spying apparatus, which are the fusion centers.
So what are some of the ways that these fusion centers were used to spy against the Occupy Wall Street protests around the country?
Well, we see that the fusion centers collected information and disseminated it on a twice-daily basis about every possible small or minor act of nonviolent protest or even expression that they were able to catalog, including by monitoring Twitter accounts, monitoring Facebook pages. Now, for example, during the period associated with Black Friday, for example, the Fusion Center here in Washington, D.C., transmitted outwards for a document about the specific known threats that related to Black Friday. That is to say that there would be persons in Seattle who might be leafleting in order to draw attention to protests that included, and these are the threats, credit card cut-ups or free non-commercial street parties that were put up as alternatives to shopping on Black Friday Day. They detailed sample anti-Black Friday icons and posters with slogans urging people to, now, like this is a threat, buy local or do your shopping at a small independent merchant. I mean, this is hundreds of millions of dollars in a massive apparatus that is supposedly supposed to be focused on anti-terrorism operations is actually focused on this type of admirable peaceful dissent and political activity.
One of the things I know was a big concern in Portland was the role of the federal coordination with local law enforcement in the crackdown on the Occupy Portland camp that ended up pretty violently disbanded, as I know a number of other camps were. Did you see evidence of a coordinated action to crack down on the Occupy camps and break up the actual encampments themselves?
Well, these details were not focused on the dismantling of the camps, but we of course know that the federal government was conveying information around the country about the camps and strategies for dealing with the camps. And in fact, there was a coordinated effort involving mayors across the country and federal law enforcement to discuss how in fact they should respond to the encampments. And shortly thereafter, you saw the dismantling of camps across the country.
Well, I do want to thank you so much for joining us. I've been speaking with Carl Massinio. He is the legal director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Their website, justiceonline.org, where you can find the report on these many documents that have been uncovered, 4,000 pages of government documents exposing the spying on the Occupy movement carried out by fusion centers that link local and federal law enforcement agencies. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Former LulzSec hacker Sabu was sentenced by a federal court in New York today to no jail time after he informed on other hackers. Sabu, whose real name is Hector Mossigner, was arrested in 2011 on charges of hacking, credit card fraud, and identity theft as part of the anonymous associated hacking group LulzSec. LulzSec rose to prominence in 2011 after high-profile attacks on Sony Pictures, multiple broadcasters, Nintendo, and the public websites of the United States Senate and the CIA. LulzSec originated as an offshoot of Anonymous, the loose international organization of activists and hacktivists that have targeted multiple government, religious, and corporate websites. Today, Mossinger received a lenient sentence of 1 year supervision and time served for his 7 months spent in prison in 2012. Government attorneys argued strongly for a lenient sentence because of his service as an informant. In a court memo, they stated that Sabu's assistance had helped disrupt at least 300 cyber attacks and had provided detailed historical information about the activities of Anonymous, contributing greatly to law enforcement's understanding of how Anonymous operates. Mossiger's cooperation was also critical to the conviction of Jeremy Hammond, who is currently serving a 10-year prison sentence for his role in hacking Stratfor, a private intelligence company.
China has called out the United States National Security Agency for unscrupulous surveillance operations. China's Internet Media Research Center issued a report yesterday which supports information released by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden about NSA surveillance of China. China's report found that the NSA had hacked into Chinese businesses, primarily computer servers in the telecommunications company Huawei, as well as servers at China's top university. According to China's report, the NSA is using cyber espionage ostensibly to fight terrorism when its operations are in fact violating human rights and breaking international laws. China's report claims the NSA's wide range of targets include the Chinese government and individual leaders, as well as Chinese companies, banks, scientific research institutes, average internet users, and cell phone users. China's administration has called on the U.S. to discontinue its cyber espionage and to respond to the claims made in the report.
This week, Governor Kitzhaber signs a bill to expand the access of state registry and referral system for home care workers. Until now, the list of trained and qualified home care aides has been for use only by people.
We're sorry. We'll go on to the next story now.
Oregonians who need home assistance will be able to get the help they need via the Oregon Home Care Commission's registry and referral system starting May 29th when the bill is signed into law. KBOO reporter Robert Fisher has more on this story.
This week, Governor Kitzhaber signs a bill to expand the access of state registry and referral system for home care workers. Until now, the list of trained and qualified home care aides has been for use only by people whose care is paid for by the state of Oregon. The legislation allows anyone to use it, and was prompted in part by reports of shortages of private home care services in some areas. Members of the Caregivers Union, SEIU, stand to gain more business from the change, although Home Care Workers Union President Rebecca Sandoval says the primary benefit is that more Oregonians should be able to get care at home.
If you have an individual who has complicated medical issues, if they have a trained professional to help track every aspect of their care, diet and their rest and their medication, and that just makes their whole care plan work so much better.
There was some pushback in the legislature from private home care service companies that said the change puts them in competition with state-funded caregivers, but advocates for the bill argue that people should be able to hire home care workers from a variety of sources. In-home care hasn't always been unionized in Oregon. When Adam Riggs started as a caregiver in Eugene 13 years ago, he says it was a minimum wage job with no benefits. With the aging population and the soaring need for at-home services, Riggs thinks organizing to add training and improve wages made sense.
That, I think, has really helped change our industry from being one where we had a lot of turnover to one where people are actually beginning to make it into a career now. I feel actually proud to have been a part of a lot of those changes.
State-paid home care workers make about $13 an hour. Sandoval says most of the unions work in Salem benefits home care clients as much as its membership. She notes every year there are attempts to trim the home care service hours of lower-income clients.
We've been able to organize and make the point repeatedly that this is a program where you don't want to cut for a lot of reasons, because of the matching federal dollars that we get for every hour of home care that the state of Oregon pays for, and we give people the ability to live in their own homes and or a care setting that they choose.
She adds taking care of people at home rather than in nursing care facilities saves the state of Oregon closer to $500 million a year. For KBOO Evening News, in collaboration with Oregon News Service, I'm Robert Fisher.
Get it all out, because now I have to.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a full report from this past weekend's March Against Monsanto, calling for increased local control over our food systems. That will be followed by Out Loud at 6. On tonight's Out Loud, they'll celebrate youth in the community. Guests on Out Loud tonight are youth and staff of the Living Room and the organizers from Oregon Queer Youth Summit and Queer Intersection Portland. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is showers likely with a high of 68 degrees and a night low of 50 degrees with a chance of showers. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 33 counts per minute in North Portland. The previous average is 32 CPM. Seattle, Washington has 39 counts per minute, and Taipei, Taiwan has 45 counts per minute with spikes up to 79. EPA alert levels start at 100 counts per minute. More information, including the definition of counts per minute, can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, on May 27, 1999, Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic was indicted by the International War Crimes Tribunal for war crimes against over 200,000 civilians, many women and children in Kosovo. The quote of the day is, quote, "The baby doll type of woman is a thing of the past, and the wide awake woman is forging ahead, prepared for all emergencies and ready to answer any call, even if it be to face the cannons on the battlefield," by Amy Jacques Garvey, wife of Marcus Garvey.
It's just about 5:38 p.m. Time for the daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Not only has the Wall Street bailout restored the banksters who wrecked our economy to full prosperity, but it's also paying off very handsomely for the bank overseers who orchestrated the bailout. For example, as chairman of the Federal Reserve for 6 years, Ben Bernanke led the bucket brigade that poured trillions of public dollars into Wall Street's vaults. So, he's now on a global Show Me Some Love tour, pocketing up to $400,000 for each speech he delivers to the financial giants he rescued with our money. Then there's Timmy Geithner, whose chief responsibility as head of the New York Fed had been to regulate Wall Street's reckless banks so their greed wouldn't cause a nationwide financial crisis. But, oops, they did exactly that on Timmy's See No Evil watch. Still, having proven himself a banker's man, Geithner was promoted to be President Obama's Treasury Secretary. There, He insisted that the government's priority must be rescuing greedy bankers with taxpayer dollars, rather than saving the millions of American homeowners stuck with bloated mortgages, facing wage cuts and joblessness, and who were sinking into deep debt and poverty. But being a banker's man, Geithner was not punished for his inept and morally deplorable policies. Rather, he was richly rewarded with a top executive position as, what else, a Wall Street banker. Now, he's published a book about his years of public screw-ups. Oh, sorry, I meant public service. Concluding that he was correct and courageous, Geithner's book should have been titled, Heck of a Job, Timmy. This is Jim Hightower saying, so Wall Street prospers, Ben and Tim wallow in wealth, and the real economy remains mired in the ditch of joblessness, low wages, household debt, and rising anger at the Wall Street Washington cabal of self-serving elites who shove them into that ditch.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
As 30-year-old female Farzana Bibi arrived in front of Lahore High Court in Pakistan, about a dozen family members, including her former fiancé, pulled her and her husband to one side and stoned her till her death, while the husband managed to escape. Pakistan police state the father stayed and turned himself in, while the former fiancé and brothers of the women are still out there. Prior to the incident, Bibi's parents filed a case against a man named Mohammed Iqbal for what they thought was a kidnapping of their daughter. Bibi then testified against her parents and said that the two had been married by her choice. And the police confirmed this. When she arrived for a hearing at the court building, her family ambushed her and stoned her to death using rocks and sticks. It's reported that marriage without consent of family in Pakistan is highly frowned upon and taboo, and rarely any tolerance for it. It has also been said that the death toll of women killed by their families in Pakistan go into the hundreds, and with strong belief that many go unannounced or not reported.
300 Palestinian administrative detainees continue their ongoing hunger strike for the 35th day in a row. Prisoners want the Israelis' use of administrative detention policy to end. Despite the critical health condition of the prisoners, an Israeli administration refuses to negotiate the prisoners' demands. On April 24th, 120 administrative prisoners started their hunger strike, demanding an end to their dictatorial detention. A month later, many more prisoners joined the strike in solidarity, including some Palestinian political leaders like Marwan Barghouti, Ahmad Sadat, and Abbas Al-Sayed, increasing the strikers' numbers to 300. Minister of the Prisoners' Affairs, Issa Karoki, said that there are 120 prisoners from the Megiddo prison who will join the strike on Thursday. This will increase the number to 420 strikers. The Palestinian Authority called for a, quote, emergency session, unquote, for the Security Council to discuss the prisoners' strike and the need for the international community to take responsibility to protect the prisoners' life and rights.
For 4 months, 80,000 miners have been on strike in South Africa. The strike reduced the world's platinum production by half. Today, a crowd of thousands, Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union members gathered in Marikana to hear the president announce the union's willingness to begin negotiations to begin operations in the mines. Workers say they will not relent until their pay is doubled. Originally, they wanted the raise immediately. Now they say they will wait 3 to 4 years for the pay increase to reach that level, even though the miners and their families are starving. Earlier this month, a large platinum company threatened to bring court action to stop the strike, citing a concern for violence perpetrated against miners who want to go back to work. Last Wednesday, AMCU members with sticks in hand prevented others from getting into the mine to work. Four miners were killed this past weekend as they tried to return. The rival union, National Union of Mine Workers, or NUM, claims it told their members to stay away from the mines because of the threat of violence. The recent call for official negotiations stemmed from a union-busting stunt perpetrated by platinum producers early this month, who, instead of using the unions for negotiation, took their most recent pay offer directly. Workers via telephone text message asking for work to vote yes or no to the increase. An official said that the SMS poll put recipients at risk for negotiation directly with management. In 2012, NUM security forces and miners were involved in the bloodiest post-apartheid era violence known as the Marikana Massacre. 34 strikers were killed, 78 wounded by South African security forces. Authorities charged 270 miners with public violence and then later tried to pin the massacre on the workers themselves. A month later, all the charges were dropped.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem. Excuse me, the latest in news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Hillary Devani, Rigel Hope, Barbara Nelson, Robert, and Mohammed Usraf. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. I'm Kristen Yount.
I'm Emily. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Andrew Giller hosts Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, on Political Perspectives, Jimmy Tardy, Brian Wilson, and Mike Hastie talk with Larry Colburn, an Army veteran who, while serving as a helicopter gunner in the Vietnam War, intervened in the My Lai massacre in 1968. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on The Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Gethardi Ramsad, author of the memoir Shadows in the Sun, Healing from Depression and Finding the Light Within. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you're not currently a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Saturday's March Against Monsanto in Portland, part of a global day of action against genetically modified crops and foods, drew over 2,000 people. A rally to kick off the march was held at Shemansky Park in southwest Portland. KBOO's Paul Rowland produced this collage of speakers from the rally. Thanks to Tiffany Ayers and Cy Abrahams for the audio.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I just want to open things up here with a message from Vandana Shiva. She has a message for everyone all around the world marching against Monsanto today, and it begins, "I send greetings of solidarity for all the people gathered for March Against Monsanto. Marching against Monsanto is marching for freedom and democracy, for health and safety, for seed and biodiversity. People often ask me, why Monsanto? My response is, we did not choose to target Monsanto. Monsanto chose to target our seed, our food freedom, our scientific and democratic institutions, our very lives. In the U.S., Monsanto uses its money to undermine the right of its citizens to know what they eat. It is threatening the state of Vermont because it got a labeling law in place. And now it has introduced a bill in Congress called the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act, which has earned itself the name DARK, Denying Americans the Right to Know Act. This is an assault on democracy and people's freedom. We seek seed freedom, food freedom, and earth democracy. The greed and violence of one corporation cannot be allowed to destroy the earth, the lives of our farmers, the freedoms of our children. That is why we are marching against Monsanto.
Are you ready? Are you ready to march against Monsanto? Are you ready to march for your human rights? You know, something is happening in Oregon. Something is in the air. Something happened in Jackson. Something happened in Josephine. And something's going to happen with labeling. And that's what we must all do, is to do our parts. Monsanto is fighting for profits. We are fighting for our lives. We are fighting for our lives.
All of these corporate entities can never buy the people. They try, but they can't, and that was just shown. And today, I want to march with all of you, because all of us together will make this change and take back seed justice, food justice, restoration of the land, and respect to the people.
From where I stand up here, I got two undeniable truths to share with you today. The food that we eat today is not the same as it was 20 years ago. And farming is not the same either. Monsanto and the GMOs are a huge part of that difference. And I, for one, want to see that trend stop. Anybody else with me? All right. In the past two decades, GMOs have become synonymous with pesticides, be that herbicides, residues from heavy use of glyphosate on GM crops, which are allowed to remain in ever-increasing levels in our food by the EPA, or insecticides that the plants themselves have been engineered to produce. Numerous scientific studies have shown these pesticides kill the beneficial gut bacteria of the human digestive tract. These studies are now linking GMOs and the pesticides they bring with them to the whole host of cascading health concerns, from IBS, leaky gut, allergies, Alzheimer's, diabetes, and obesity. GMO food labeling is an important tool to enable consumers, physicians, and scientists to identify unintended health effects from eating GMOs. Globally, more than 65 countries already require labeling on foods containing GMO ingredients. Opponents of GMO labeling in the U.S., like Coke, Nestle, and General Mills, already comply with GMO labeling requirements globally with the foods they distribute, or they source non-GMO replacement ingredients. These same companies should be required to do the exact same thing here. Agriculturally, GMO crops are advertised as reducing pesticide use or providing better yields. In actuality, since GMO agriculture has begun, our use of pesticides has skyrocketed, resulting in super weeds and super bugs, which need new and increasing amounts of pesticides to control. This results in the killing of beneficial soil and pollinator organisms and polluting our watersheds and ecosystems. Additionally, GMO crops have failed to deliver on any promise of better yields and risk contaminating non-GMO fields, a risk that our fine state of Oregon here cannot risk with our crops like wheat and the specialty seed industry. Oregon needs to take a stance and protect our local farmers. Oregon needs to take a stance and protect our environment. Oregon needs to take a stance and protect the organic industry that Oregon is globally known for. Oregon needs to take a stance and protect our citizens' right to know what they are eating. GMO labeling is an incredibly important tool. I am incredibly proud and pleased to be standing here today, actually out here, collecting signatures on this effort. It's an amazing and a critical part for me as a father to be able to buy the kinds of food that I think is going to make a better life for my kids. I deserve to know what it is I'm feeding my children. Opponents of GMO labeling will tell me to go buy organic. That's a great thing. I do that as much as I can, but like many of us, I can't afford to do that all the time. Many people can't afford to buy organic. They should not have to suffer just because they can't afford to buy organic. They deserve the exact same rights as everybody else. GMO labeling is on an upswing. I know it lost in 2013 in Washington, in 2012 in California. Those were really narrow margins. They lost 51-49. There's a whole host of reasons why. In Washington, one of the biggest ones was voter turnout. one of the biggest things you guys can do for us is get out and vote this October. Vote for GMO labeling when you guys see it this fall. Vermont just passed GMO labeling in their legislature. We're Oregon Right to Know. I'm GMO Free Oregon, but we're pushing the Oregon Right to Know. Give me a woohoo for anybody who signed this today.
Right? Food is medicine. Monsanto and these other chemical companies are trying to make it poison, and we are not going to let that happen. Right now, GMOs are created for two reasons that both involve pesticides. A seed's gene is engineered to stay alive when high doses of pesticides like Roundup is applied to kill weeds around it. Or a seed's gene is engineered so it can produce its own form of pesticide that kills pests that try to eat it. There are no health benefits from GMOs, and GMOs do not increase yields. Both these things, Monsanto says, just aren't true. GMOs are primarily created by six chemical companies. Monsanto is the biggest and most pervasive. Others are Dow, BASF, Bayer, Syngenta, and DuPont. All have spent millions, tens of millions, in other states to block consumers from getting information on food labels. These companies are right here, right now, trying to do the same thing in Oregon. Besides Roundup that's used with GMOs, other chemicals Monsanto has produced include DDT, which has been banned, PCBs, which has been banned, saccharin, it's also been banned, RGBH growth hormone, it's highly regulated, and Agent Orange, which has been banned. But the EPA may approve an Agent Orange ingredient, 2,4-D, to put on GMO crops. GMOs have not been banned, they're not regulated, and they're not labeled. To this day, Monsanto does not admit that Agent Orange has killed members of our military. Too many veterans have suffered and died from Monsanto's Agent Orange, and too many families' lives have changed forever. This is not the America that we want. We do not want Monsanto to control our food with chemicals they created for war.
Wouldn't it be great if we could simply pass a legally binding ordinance that would ban GMO foods? And not only that, strip corporations like Monsanto of their so-called corporate rights. Well, I'm here today to tell you that we actually can. Does it seem impossible? If it does, it's because we are conditioned to believe that we are powerless. If you've long suspected that we are not actually a democracy, it's because we're not. Does it ever feel like we're living in a kind of like a democracy theme park? You know, you go into the little booth, you pull the lever, you pick up the phone, you call your senator, but nothing's connected to anything. It's all just bells and whistles. Well, this is the case. It's the wealthy elite who actually make the decisions here. Some would call this a broken system. Some would say the system's been hijacked. If you ask me, the system is designed that way. But what I'm here to share with you today is that people have found a way to fight the monster and win. I'm going to tell you about 200 communities across the country, towns, municipalities, counties, who have partnered with something called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, based in Pennsylvania. These communities have successfully banned fracking. They have successfully banned factory farms. They have successfully banned hazardous waste dumping. What's more important, none of these 200 bans have been successfully challenged and overturned by corporations. Now the question is, how did they do this, right? If it seems like we're in a rigged system, and we are, how did they do this? Now this is very important. They did not just place a ban. Because if they did, if they just placed a ban on the fracking or whatever, well, the corporation would come in, challenge it in court, and say it violates their constitutional rights, which it does, and they would overturn it. So what these communities did, what the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund helped them to do, was they asserted that their rights to basic health and safety, are more important than the corporation's rights to turn a profit. Okay? It seems like a basic truth, right? But you have to say this in court. And furthermore, they refuse to play by the rules of a rigged system. built into these ordinances, which are really mini constitutions, is a statement that that municipality refuses to recognize the constitutional rights of those corporations. Okay? So this is disobedience. This is what you have to do when the system is rigged. Let me give some examples of this. In Mora County, New Mexico, this is the first county in the U.S. to ban all hydrocarbon extraction, including fracking. This is currently being challenged in court. We'll see how it plays out. In Colorado, there is a statewide initiative going on the ballot that would challenge state preemption of these kinds of ordinances, right? This is where a company like Monsanto, this is happening in Oregon, a company like Monsanto comes in and manages to pass a law saying communities can't organize like this, makes it illegal for us to organize like this. Well, Colorado is putting an initiative on the state ballot to make this sort of preemption illegal. Here in Oregon, there are two counties, Benton County and Lane County, both agricultural counties. Both have ordinances going to the ballot that would establish a right to a sustainable food system, including things like a right to a seed heritage. What these ordinances would do is they would ban the growing of GMO crops. And furthermore, they would strip corporations like Monsanto of their so-called corporate rights that they use like a shield. Here in Portland, we have a local group. We are discussing the possibility of a countywide Bill of Rights to a sustainable and healthy food system, which would ban, it would place a ban on GMO-based ingredients being sold anywhere in the county. Now keep in mind, ordinances like this are, they violate the U.S. Constitution. They are acts of disobedience. What they do, they set up a crisis of jurisdiction. Who's in charge, right? The corporations and the federal government, or local communities like ours, to make decisions about our basic health and welfare. I want to read you a brief excerpt from, this is from Article 1, Section 1 of our Oregon State Constitution. This is the highest law in the land. It says, all power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on this authority and instituted for their peace, safety, and happiness, and they, the people, have at all times a right to alter, reform, or abolish the government in such a manner as they think proper. This is written into our Constitution. This is the power we have. And I'm coming close to the end, but I also want to read you, this is very exciting. In a recent ruling, a Pennsylvania judge, this is a hero, Debbie Odell Seneca, a Pennsylvania judge, in striking down a case from a corporation